I went to bed early and had what I can only describe as a very troubled night, waking up very distressed with a terrible feeling of foreboding. On impulse, I called the airline and asked if I could postpone my flight by a day. "That is quite all right," they replied, "but what about the royal bag which has already gone out to the airport?" "Would you mind putting it on the aircraft?" I asked, "and I will collect it in Singapore." They were very happy to do this for me. The first thing I read in the headlines the following morning was that the flight I should have been on had crashed and burst into flames on the approach to Cheney Airfield, and all on board had perished in the wreckage. 24 hours later, I had the eerie experience of approaching over the scarred ground and burnt out wreckage which might so easily have been my own grave. The Royal Mail bag was salvaged, and I still have pieces of its contents scorched by the fire and stained by the foam of fire extinguishers. It is easy to explain this away as a coincidence: too good a dinner, an upset stomach, a slight fever, a nightmare. But I've flown millions of miles in my life, and this was the only time I have ever cancelled a flight on such an impulse. I became no more religious in the conventional sense, but I have felt on a number of occasions the presence of an external force and believe strongly in the power of prayer. This power was demonstrated when I was air officer commanding No. 1 Bomber Group at Bawtry, near Doncaster. Leonard Cheshire had been invited to preside at a reunion dinner at No. 617 Dambuster Squadron on a Friday night at Trafscampton, its home base, and one of the stations under my command. Leonard rang me up and said, "Peter, I have a problem. It is terribly important I get to Lyon on Saturday morning to attend the opening of one of our first homes in France by a French minister, and I cannot get there by civil aircraft in time. Do you think the RAF could fly me there?" There are all sorts of difficulties to doing this kind of thing in peacetime when the service is so closely controlled by the civil service financial branches. At any rate, I rang Strike Command headquarters with the request, who said that in no way was this a starter, and I had to relay the bad news back to Leonard Cheshire. After a few days, I thought again. Damn it, there must be a way to get round the regulations. And then I remembered Michael Carey, who was a permanent under-secretary in the Ministry of Defence in London and who had been at the Dragon Preparatory School in Oxford with both Leonard Cheshire and myself. I rang him up and told him our problem. "Peter," he said, "do you have any navigation training flights in the group?" "Yes," I replied, "we run some Argosy missions to Gibraltar." "Okay," he came back. "Lay one on for the Saturday in question from Scampton and let it land at Lyon en route to Gibraltar, dropping off Cheshire, and I will fix it all at this end with the financiers." I rang back Leonard Cheshire with the glad tidings. He didn't sound surprised and said, "Well, Peter, I wasn't worried, particularly, as I have been praying you would find a way to get me there." I attended a very successful and boisterous dinner at Scampton, and Leonard went off the following morning to meet the French minister and open another home. 8. The road ahead. I stumbled through this dark and menacing room, still pursued by strange sounds and voices, emerging into a short corridor towards the rear of the house. The road ahead proved a difficult one, and I seemed to take 2 steps forward and then 1 back, but at least I was moving forward. In what direction I was not quite sure. Once I had arrived at the RAF Loughborough Rehabilitation Centre, I felt secure, wrapped in a cocoon of doctors and nurses and surrounded by patients in various stages of recovery from their wounds, some worse than mine and some better. Slowly I fitted into a small coterie of fairly heavy drinkers, and once our daily labours were finished we used to haunt the pubs around Loughborough, frightening their local inhabitants with our burnt and broken bodies. One of my friends at this time was Flight Lieutenant Fielding Johnson, whose son had been on 21 Squadron with me. They had been both awarded the DFC on the same day, and shortly afterwards the son was killed in a low-level daylight mosquito raid on Germany, which had been ambushed by a large number of German single-engine fighters. The best thing about the hospital was the little Belgian nurse who came into my room one morning and found me with a shivering attack, a relic of the sea, and immediately took off her clothes, got into bed and surrounded me with her pink, warm flesh. My day consisted of a number of one-hour periods of exercises, full legs, full arms, volleyball, bicycling interspersed with bouts of swimming. The psychiatrist I had seen on my arrival was convinced I had become frightened of the water, which was the very reverse of the truth, as I felt closely involved with the sea which I looked on as a friend. So I had to swim 2 or 3 times a day, overseen by a bemused swimming instructor who had been told to keep me in the water at all costs. In fact, he had nothing to do but watch. I was finally expelled from the hospital in disgrace. My little gang, who had been out on a particularly rowdy pub crawl, came back and gathered around a fountain which was situated on a lawn in front of the hospital. We had all undressed, some unwinding their bandages, and with one great whoop we all jumped in and splashed around until our yelling brought out the duty doctor, who was not at all amused by our antics. The following morning I stood to attention in front of the group captain, commanding officer, who informed me that my presence was no longer required at the hospital and told me to report to a medical board in London, where I would undoubtedly be boarded out of the RAF. I was no longer fit enough to be a pilot, and at any rate we were at that stage of the war where there were plenty of aircrew just waiting to fill my shoes. Instead of reporting to the medical board, I returned to No. 140 Wing at Thorny Island, who were just packing up their tents to leave for France. From there I rang my air officer commanding, Air Vice Marshal Basil Embry, and asked him if I could return to the wing. "I am sorry, Peter," he said, "I cannot let you go back on operations. It would be just too bad if you were killed without a medical category. However, you can leave today and join the 2nd Tactical Air Force Communication Squadron, which is presently based at Amiens, and just hope the medical authorities don't catch up with you." That was all I needed. I set off to fly ensigns following the advancing British Army through France, Belgium, and finally Germany. I had first to overcome my fears, both conscious and unconscious, fear of flying and in particular fear of flying over water. In the next year or so I flew so many cross-channel trips, from the short route Dover to Calais and the longer route Dover to Ostend, that I learned to grip hard on the flying controls and sweat it out. Gradually my fears receded, although for years I had the lurking shadows follow me when flying over long stretches of the sea. In due course I was appointed personal pilot to the Chief of Staff of 21 Army Group and flew our own personal ensign. One of the earliest trips that I did was to fly General Montgomery's watch to London for repair. It sat in solitary splendor beside me on the co-pilot's seat. At about this time I was doing weekly trips with the Major General Administration, Miles Graham, to Rear Army Headquarters near Brussels, then on to Shape in Paris, and finally to the War Office in London. There was one particular flight I remember with Miles Graham at the beginning of December, 1944, when the fog came down at the same time as the Germans broke through in the Ardennes with the intention of advancing and retaking Antwerp. Miles Graham was ordered by Montgomery to return immediately to Brussels, and we began a verbal battle as to whether or not I would take off. Finally, against my better judgment, I took off from Northolt and headed out above the fog towards Brussels. When we arrived over Brussels it was still shrouded in fog. I made 2 or 3 stabs on ground controlled approach. Once I saw a ploughed field skim by just 10 feet below. I pulled up and tried again. I made one last attempt, down, down I came with one eye on the altimeter and one eye peering out into the murky dark fog. Suddenly and very quickly I saw lights ahead and the terrified looks of people flinging themselves down on the floor. I revved up the engines, pulling the ensign up and just missing the Evia control tower by a matter of feet. I had had enough and headed west into the countryside where, through a gap in the fog, I caught a glimpse of a runway. I immediately put down the undercarriage and landed straight ahead. It was a disused airfield and it took a little time to find a local inhabitant from whom we could inquire where we were. The general commandeered a car and set off for Brussels with the Germans just a few miles away still advancing, leaving me stranded with the aircraft. A few days afterwards, on New Year's Day, The Luftwaffe fueled their aeroplanes with the last drop of fuel remaining in Germany and attacked Allied airfields with guns and bombs. Most of us had been partying the night before and arrived back at our airfield bleary-eyed. As the guns began to chatter across the aerodrome, I dived under the nearest vehicle with the squadron adjutant, only to find it was a petrol bowser and I was with the last man with whom I would wish to die. Johnny Johnson's Spitfire wing at Evia managed to get a flight off the ground, but the number two in the formation was attacked just as he raised the undercarriage and his engine blew up. He force-landed straight ahead on top of an apartment building, lifted his canopy, stepped up on the roof and stepped down to a very surprised Belgian lady who was having her bath in the room below. The war now began to reach its climax and the Allied armies moved into Germany itself. I took a covey of generals which included the Chief of Staff, Freddy de Gingand, and Miles Graham to land beside the Rhine. There they all lined up, lowered their trousers and peed into it. Generals can still behave like small boys. And so the Allies sped on into the heartland of Germany, finally ending up on the Elbe. There, by agreement with the Russians, they called a halt. Early one morning I was summoned by the Chief of Staff and asked if I would volunteer for a special mission, to fly my Anson into enemy-held territory and land at Fassburg to pick up General Admiral von Friedeberg and his staff and fly them back to Montgomery's caravan at Lüneburg Heath. In the event of the General Admiral not turning up, I was to raise the undercarriage of my Anson and give myself up. A major was detailed to fly with me. I set off on Form A, crossing the front line at low level. I expected that I should have to take violent evasive action to escape flak, but the guns were silent. It was as though a bugle had blown, ending the war, and all the German troops had deserted their posts to go home. It was an eerie experience flying across a deserted countryside. Right on time Fassburg came up, I was given a green light from the ground and landed, taxied up to the control tower, was waved in by two German airmen and switched off my engines, leaving my navigator in charge of the Anson, ready to raise the undercarriage on my instructions. I got out to the smart salute of the German airmen and was escorted up a flight of stairs to the control tower. There an exact replica of an RAF scene took place. The German duty pilot booked me in, Flight Lieutenant Horsley, Aircraft Anson, Number, Place of Origin. It was all so meticulous that I was quite enjoying it and was given a welcome cup of coffee and a chair to sit on. Meanwhile, outside on the airfield, it was as if someone had come along with a stick and stuck it into a beehive, stirring up the bees to intense activity. A wide variety of aircraft flew in, refueled and took off again, including a jet ME-262, in the last mad German scramble to find a safe haven somewhere in the south. A JU-52 landed and was immediately boarded by a party of sinister-looking gentlemen in long black Macintoshes, taking off again in a last desperate attempt to escape retribution for their foul misdeeds. Half an hour passed and finally a cavalcade of cars sped up to the control tower and General Admiral von Friedeberg, the personal representative of Grand Admiral Dönitz, and his entourage gathered by the aeroplane. With a salute which was hardly returned, I ushered them into the Anson. Once again, after a green light from the tower, I took off and headed towards Lüneburg. There I was met by Major General Graham. An even larger cavalcade of cars sped towards Lüneburg Heath with myself and the escorting major in the last one. The Germans were ushered into Montgomery's large marquee where they signed the instrumental surrender, watched by me from one of Monty's caravans conveniently parked close by. So, from a distance, I had witnessed an historic occasion. In due course I was recommended by 21 Army Group for the award of an Air Force Cross, with which King George VI presented me. Little did I realize that the next time I should see him would be a few days before his death. Germany had been reduced to rubble by bombing and the advancing armies. There were two worlds, the one occupied by refugees, gaunt and hollow-eyed, fleeing west from the Russians, and the other well-fed, in their smart uniforms and staff cars. As there was a no fraternization ban in force, the two worlds just looked at each other, silent and curious. My aeroplane was now based at Trafbuckburg while I was billeted in a comfortable house at Bad Einhorsen. In due course I was appointed RAF liaison officer to 21 Army Group, as well as personal pilot to the Chief of Staff. My wife and son, aged 2, joined me. I had been given an Army Batman. Gunner Leon was a most delightful old rogue, climbing the Army ladder several times to sergeant, only to be busted down again to private for some misdemeanor. I caught him on the last rung. Whenever we wanted a chicken or some German gin, it would mysteriously appear with the compliments of Gunner Leon. I once remarked to him that I could really do with some new pajamas. A few days later Leon appeared with the most exquisite material, which was quickly made up by the German tailor into several pairs of pajamas. My wife happened to be having tea with the Chief of Staff's wife, who lived in a fine house just down the road from us, and who showed her the drawing room windows bereft of curtains, adding, "It was quite extraordinary, my dear. They disappeared just like that the other day. I am glad she didn't have to go to bed with me." Towards the end of my time in Germany, I found that my station commander had put my name forward for a permanent commission. I duly passed my medical A1G1, which meant I was fully fit for aircrew, so my medical records from Loughborough had still not caught up with me, and I was duly gazetted as a permanent flight lieutenant in the Royal Air Force, all without trying very hard. In 1947 I returned to England 2 years after the end of the war and felt a stranger in my native land. Gone was the wartime spirit of sacrifice, to be replaced by an atmosphere of selfishness, of spivs and the black market, and an attitude of "I'm all right, Jack," with everyone trying to gain advantage over his neighbor in a country of shortages and rations. I was posted to Headquarters No. 23 Training Group as an assistant to Wing Commander Arthur Donaldson, DSO, DFC. One brother, Baldy, had died in the Norwegian Sea after his squadron was evacuated to the carrier HMS Glorious when she was sunk by the German battleships Scharnhorst and Gneisenau. Only 2 squadron pilots survived on a raft in the Arctic seas to tell the tale. The second brother, Teddy, won fame breaking the world speed record in a meteor jet. After a few months, Arthur Donaldson wangled me back onto an instructor's course at Little Rissington. This course was quite different from the one I had completed in 1941. The students were not only required to qualify as instructors on Tiger Moths and Harvards, but also as instructors on more advanced aircraft such as the Spitfire, Mosquito, Lancaster and, finally, the new Jet Vampire. The Spitfire was only a single-engine Mosquito and I had no trouble flying it at all. The Lancaster, with its 4 engines, was a novelty, but I got the hang of it fairly quickly. The Vampire was a different kettle of fish, rather like flying a Hoover. Being a seasoned pilot, I was handed a copy of the pilot's notes and told to get on with flying it. My first flight in the new jet was an unnerving experience. I started it up and it sounded just like a vacuum cleaner. The early jet accelerated very slowly, at first gasping for air and flying speed down the short wartime runways. Gradually getting more confident, it seemed to gasp and gulp the air down. Thus, with the absence of the noise and vibration of a piston-engined aircraft, it often convinced newcomers that something was seriously wrong. It certainly did me, but as the end of the runway loomed up and I was obviously fully committed, I was pleasantly surprised to find that on hauling back on the stick this new bird leapt into the air with the grace of a bird. The Vampire climbed cheerfully away, still sounding like a vacuum cleaner, and flying it soon began to feel like fun. Suddenly you experienced a completely new freedom of cutting huge chunks of sky, carving it into figures with all the ease and grace of a skater dancing on clouds instead of ice. Even at the Central Flying School, little was yet known all about supersonic flight. The Meteor had been rushed into service to be used against the flying bombs. Group Captain Teddy Donaldson had flown one in the high-speed flight at Tangmere at 611 miles per hour, Mach 81, a true airspeed close to the speed of sound at a very low altitude. During a visit to his brother Arthur at Leighton Buzzard, Teddy had described to me the violent buffeting which began as he reached compressibility. Supersonic speed then seemed an impenetrable barrier, especially after the experimental DH-108 had broken up, killing the pilot Jeffrey de Havilland when attempting to achieve the breakthrough. We were taught at CFS that you could not get into much trouble provided you experimented in thin air above 30,000 feet. My instructor demonstrated how you could climb a Meteor to 40,000 feet, open the throttle fully, turn the aircraft on its back and pull it through. The Meteor would then fall like a proverbial brick, quickly reaching its terminal velocity of 0.84 Mach, protesting and shaking violently. It took all of another 10,000 feet to straighten her out again, leaving a confused and sometimes bruised pilot. It was not a very popular exercise. The first indication that things were not proceeding normally came about halfway through the course when a signal arrived addressed personal for Flight Lieutenant Horsley summoning me for an interview with the wing commander in the Directorate of Personnel in the Air Ministry. I wondered what heinous crime had possibly followed me from Germany. What I did not know at the time was that I was starting off down a new road which would eventually lead me to the Air Member for Personnel himself. So one wet and miserable morning I duly presented myself in a well-pressed best blue uniform before Wing Commander Spencer. Without beating about the bush, he asked whether I would like to be considered, among other candidates, for the post of Extra-Equerry to their Royal Highnesses Princess Elizabeth and the Duke of Edinburgh. I had no knowledge of the processes in the Air Ministry for sorting the sheep from the goats, but at that moment I was a sheep and, without further thought, I answered, yes. The wing commander pointed out that my financial affairs had to be more than sound and my domestic situation impeccable. I told a white lie about both. My financial situation was just all right. I had worked through the money from the sale of my grandmother's slum property and had about £700 left. My marriage, on the other hand, had just passed through a crisis and we were still gingerly feeling our way forward. That boat was leaking, but at least was still afloat. I returned to Little Rissington elated. The sea had drained me of much more than just physical energy. For the first time since my escape, I felt a quickening of the pulse and a renewed interest in life. My senses stirred sharply at the thought of this entirely new road opening up before me, and I felt like a lioness getting the first scent of a prey borne on a freshening breeze. The process of elimination continued for the next month or so. Some progressed from the wing commander's embraces to move on to the group captain and the survivors, then on to an air commodore. Finally, only three of us were left for interview by the next to God himself, an air vice marshal. The interview with the Director General of Personnel could not have taken place under less auspicious conditions, and I would have preferred a more suitable occasion at which to shine as a possible courtier. It so happened that the Director General was the guest of honor at the final course guest night. Whilst the Commandant with his VIP and other distinguished guests retired to the bar, the rest of us settled down, if that is the right phrase, to the usual rough mess games in the anteroom. The station adjutant extracted me from the bottom of a rugger scrum and ordered me to report forthwith to the Commandant. I was in poor shape, minus collar and bow tie, my white stiff shirt spotted with blood and my mess jacket missing. However, by this time I had imbibed sufficient alcohol not to care very much anyway. So I duly reported to the Commandant, Air Commodore MacDonald, and his very important guest, the Director General. The Air Vice Marshal was, of course, immaculate as all Air Vice Marshals should be, and he must have been surprised to see such a figure before him, even if he was decent enough not to show it. He did at least have a twinkle in his eyes which seemed to say that he was no stranger to the antics of young pilots on guest nights. I imagined that was the end of that. It had been fun while it lasted. At the end of the course I was posted as adjutant to my old friend of Canadian days, Wing Commander Christopher Foxley Norris, at Oxford University Air Squadron. I settled down at Oxford happily enough, renting a small Cotswold cottage in the village of Stonefield on the edge of the Blenheim Palace estate. The Oxford University Air Squadron was quite unlike any other RAF unit in which I had served. The squadron was commanded by a wing commander, usually an ex-Oxford graduate himself, and consisted of a squadron leader chief flying instructor, a flight lieutenant adjutant, a civilian chief ground instructor, Jack Akers, and a civilian secretary, Olive Round, both of whom had been with the Oxford University Air Squadron for a very long time and knew everything there was to know about the peculiarities of university air squadrons. Finally, there were four or five flying instructors. In 1948, the students were about equally divided between very experienced ex-RAF wartime pilots continuing or starting their university degrees on very slender grants or new graduates, one or two of whom it was hoped would join the RAF when they graduated, a former Chief of the Defence Staff, Marshal of the Royal Air Force Lord Craig, was a young cadet whom I had taught to fly during my time as adjutant. The town headquarters was housed in old tin buildings just off Manor Road, next door to the very splendid and new brick building of our army equivalent. However, our small squadron mess was immensely popular and one of the great attractions for impecunious students, offering excellent food and drink at what must have been the lowest prices in Oxford. My work was congenial and undemanding, gentle paperwork in the mornings. Anything difficult I had only to refer to Jack Akers or Olive Round to find an answer, followed by lunch with the students and a drive over to RAF Abingdon with the other instructors and students in the afternoons for flying instruction. The WAS did not have the usual discipline of the RAF unit, yet was not quite as free and easy as a flying club either, with an unwritten constitution somewhere just between. While I went about my duties as adjutant under the watchful eye of the Co., I was never quite sure what my colleagues were up to. The chief flying instructor, squadron leader Guy Corey, a man of immense talent and charm, was at the same time reading for a university degree. Another instructor, flight lieutenant Trevor Gallagher, a tall, craggy New Zealander, was also taking a degree at Merton College, training for his Blue in the Oxford boat and studying for his RAF promotion examination, all with a very pregnant wife. How he managed to keep all these activities under some semblance of control was beyond imagination. The remaining instructors seemed to have other interests. Tiger David was the caricature of pilot officer prune, albeit a very elderly one, complete with white handlebar moustache which he constantly twirled and groomed with military precision. He had been at Wellington College in the mid-20s, taken an RAF short service commission and reached his ceiling as a flight lieutenant with 8,000 hours instructing on tiger moths in his logbook. As far as I could see, Tiger spent his free time evading either the money lenders or the police, for various minor motoring offences. It was perhaps fortunate for him that the breathalyzer was not invented in those days. He kept his companions and fellow instructors fascinated by his descriptions of his exploits with the Rozzers the previous evening. Tiger left the service and became landlord of a pub. This was a fatal course for him and for his wife, both developing into their own best customers. I last saw Tiger David, some years later, as the driver in a long queue of commercial vans on their way to Southampton Docks for export. There were only two incidents I remember well during my short period at Oxford. The first occurred when I was teaching a student how to make a forced landing in a field following engine failure. During his own attempt, I allowed him to glide the aircraft far too close to a high bramble hedge on the far edge of the field. I took over only just in time to avoid a complete disaster, opening up the engine, but still flew through the top of the hedge, carrying a small plantation embedded in the wings back to base. On an RAF unit there would have undoubtedly been a formal inquiry, but on such an unconventional unit the damage was repaired and no report made. The second incident was far more serious and may well have shortened Guy Corey's career in the RAF. One of my students was a young man called Nicholas who had some previous flying experience but whose ability, in my opinion, had been suspect from the start. On this particular occasion, When I was on leave, the CFI took Nicholas on a two-aircraft dogfighting exercise in the low-flying area. During the ensuing series of maneuvers, Nicholas spun into the ground. He was removed from the wreckage, lucky to be alive but with one leg very badly injured.